Is Rick Perry right that the 17th Amendment was a mistake? By Justia Verdict columnist Vikram David Amar and guest columnist Alan Brownstein. Among the many provocative things Republican presidential candidate Rick Perry has said is that the American people mistakenly empowered the federal government during a fit of populist rage in the early 20th century by changing the way senators are elected via the 17th Amendment. In this column, we analyze why the 17th Amendment, providing for the direct election of U.S. senators, came about, and whether it would be a good and/or workable idea, as Perry suggests, to repeal it. Most historians and legal commentators agree on the basic story of Senate election methods. In 1787, the framers and ratifiers of the original Constitution chose legislative election largely to safeguard the existence and interests of the state governments. Roger Sherman of Connecticut summed up the thinking of the Philadelphia Convention when he remarked, "If it were in view to abolish the state governments, the elections ought to be by the people. If the state governments are to be continued, it is necessary, in order to preserve harmony between the national and state governments, that the elections to the former should be made by the latter." Proponents of legislative election also relied on a secondary and less often invoked justification, the notion that state legislatures would serve as filters of popular passion and elect a better class of people to the Senate than would be produced by direct election. As James Madison observed in Federalist No. 62, the selection of senators by state legislatures has the advantage of favoring a select appointment. The move from legislative to direct election, which began in the early to mid-19th century and built up steam with the coming of the Progressive Era, was driven by a variety of sentiments, including the dissatisfaction with deadlocks in state legislatures that delayed the filling of vacant senatorial seats, the perception that bribery and corruption had tainted the state legislature's choice of senators, and the belief that state legislatures were not good representatives of the people because they were often gerrymandered for partisan and/or racial reasons. Related to these more pragmatic concerns was a core philosophical commitment. Popular election, its backers insisted, would accord better with the democratic ideals on which the Constitution was founded. The belief that state legislatures, acting as filters, would choose wiser or better senators was obsolete by the Progressive Era. 100 years of popular election of officials at both the state and federal levels had demonstrated that the electorate was worthy of higher trust. Opponents of popular election argued that the charges of corruption in the indirect election process were exaggerated, that popular election would in fact increase the influence of interest groups, and that direct election would reduce the deliberative character of the Senate. Some, although surprisingly few, also pointed out that popular election would reduce the ability of the Senate to represent and protect the interests of states qua states. These, then, were the forces that culminated in the 17th Amendment's adoption in 1913. Governor Perry has argued that with the advent of direct election, states handed over significant chunks of their sovereignty to the federal government because direct election, quote, dealt a blow to the ability of the states to exert influence on the federal government, close quote. In this regard, we think he has a point. State legislative election of senators was, in 1787, thought to be the most important device by which state government could protect itself from federal domination. Thus, the modern Supreme Court overstated its point when it suggested, most famously, for example, in Garcia v. San Antonio Metropolitan Transit Authority, that courts need not protect states from federal overreaching because the Constitution's design gives state governments sufficient clout over federal institutions to protect themselves. This contention improperly ignores the significant change in state influence on Washington that was brought about by the shift away from the election of senators by state legislatures to elections by the people. One might try to argue that the 17th Amendment reflects a changed national attitude about whether states as states ought to be protected from federal domination. If indirect election was a substantial protection for states in 1787, and if as a nation we made a conscious decision to eliminate that device, perhaps the change reveals how little value we place on protecting states. But the court has never made such an argument, and we are glad it has not. In fact, the 17th Amendment was enacted for reasons largely unrelated to federalism. The weakening effect it had on state government vis-a-vis the federal government seems to have gone relatively unnoticed, and certainly was not proclaimed as a desired and intended effect. The move to direct election was more about populism than about federalism, and the loss of strong protection for state government seems like collateral damage. But none of this means that the 17th Amendment was on balance a bad thing. Even for those of us who care about making sure states remain free from federal excesses. And it also does not mean that a return to state legislative election for senators would be advisable, even if it were politically feasible. If the history of the 17th Amendment reveals anything, it is the American people's distrust and skepticism of state legislatures, which in turn reflects a number of specific concerns. First, those who pushed for direct election of U.S. senators often blamed partisan excess and party machinations for the legislative deadlocks and filling Senate vacancies. In state legislatures that were closely divided between the two parties, the reform proponents both invoked and criticized these dirty tricks and sharp parliamentary practices. As famous Senate historian George Haynes has noted, in Colorado in 1903, for example, in an episode cited by 17th Amendment proponents, each party accused the other of fraudulent behavior and tried to enlist the coercive arm of the state to punish the other. The Democrats had at their back the police of Denver, while the Republicans appealed to the governor for troops, and for a time, chaos and bloodshed seemed inevitable. In other notable instances, in Kentucky in 1896, threats and assault between government leaders in the legislature became so frequent that the governor felt forced to call out the militia, and for 3 days the legislature met in a capital filled with troops enforcing martial law. Given the recent partisan episodes in Wisconsin and other states over the treatment of public sector union members, it is not hard to imagine that strife between the two major parties and between the upper and lower legislative houses in many states could result in prolonged Senate vacancies today. And in a modern era when government must act quickly in times of national emergency, having seats in the Senate open for lengthy period of times is even more problematic. At a minimum, then, any repeal of the 17th Amendment should leave in place the current authorization states enjoy to confer power to governors to fill Senate vacancies that arise before a senator's term ends. Beyond a concern for partisan gridlock, moreover, is a worry about the possibility of legislative corruption. As one modern commentator has put it, corruption of both state legislators and senators was the greatest evil blamed on the system of indirect election. Whether widely held 19th century perceptions of corruption were justified is a more complicated matter. Haynes summarizes, how often resort has been to had to bribery and corruption in state legislatures in connection with senatorial elections, it is impossible to determine. But there is indisputable evidence that a number of legislatures were thus tainted in the interest of certain candidates, and that this tendency was not lessened, but greatly increased after, if not because of, the enactment of the federal law of 1866 that attempted to reduce the incidence of state legislative gridlock. But perhaps even more important than overt corruption is the malapportionment problem that remains vexing today. Although largely unnoticed in the most modern discussions of direct Senate election, the antiquated systems of representation that were, and to some extent still are, used to draw state legislative districts, and the resulting unfairness to and misrepresentation of the people was clear, if not always trumpeted, in the early 1900s. Such malapportioned systems caused the legislature's election of senators to give far different results from those which would have been yielded by popular elections. Haynes describes one instance in which Democrats held the governorship for a 13-year period and won the state's presidential electors repeatedly, suggesting that they had a working majority of the state's electorate during those years. He points out, but in all that period, they elected but one senator, and he was sent to Washington for but 3 years to fill a vacancy. As one legislative report advocating the elimination of state legislative elections for senators in 1892 put the point. Under the present mode of election of senators, the legislatures may be induced to make an unfair apportionment and lay off unequal and unfair districts in order that the party temporarily in control in the legislature may reap the reward of the election of one of its partisans to the Senate and defeat the popular choice of the majority party in the state. Even those congresspersons who filed a minority report on the question of moving toward direct election acknowledged the problem of political gerrymandering. It would be good to do away with the legislative gerrymandering of the states to secure the election of United States senators by the party happening to be in power when each new apportionment is made. That this has long been the common practice, no fair-minded, intelligent man will deny. That it will continue until the temptation to it is removed, or our fundamental law is otherwise changed, is to be reasonably expected. The law of retaliation, to some extent, will always be applied. Of course, certain kinds of gerrymandering, which tended to work to the disadvantage of urban dwellers, and, relatedly, persons of color, are no longer possible in light of the Supreme Court's one-person, one-vote decisions. But concerns about partisan gerrymandering, by which a party that does not have a statewide majority might still control a majority of state legislative seats, are not eliminated by one-person, one-vote principles. In the recent Viet versus Jubilair case from Pennsylvania, the Supreme Court recognized the problem of partisan gerrymandering and its incompatibility with democratic self-government, but lamented the inability of federal courts to police the problem. An attempted repeal of the 17th Amendment would have to confront the dissonance between electing senators from a body that is the result of deliberately skewed districts designed to thwart the popular will, and electing senators directly from the state polity, which is structurally immune from such distortion and manipulation. Finally, there is a serious question of whether a repeal of the 17th Amendment could, in practice, ever really return power to state legislatures, even if, for federalism reasons, we wanted to do so. In other words, popular control of Senate elections may be inevitable, no matter what the Constitution formally says. To see this, consider one additional aspect of the story of the 17th Amendment, an aspect that focuses on innovations by the peoples of the various states. Beginning in the mid-1800s, state-level political parties and organizations sought ways to involve the people more directly in selecting Senate electors. Perhaps the most important step in this journey was the advent of a statewide preference poll to be conducted in connection with a statewide election. Oregon was a pioneer in this regard in the early 1900s. Under the Oregon Plan, as it became known, state voters held, as part of the regular election, a preference poll that would not legally elect senators, but would rather inform the choice to be made by state legislators. Individual state legislators were encouraged to officially pledge to support the winners of the poll. Subsequent versions of the plan sought to bind, as a matter of state law, state legislators to elect as a senator the person who gained the greatest support from the state's general electorate. By 1909, Nebraska and Nevada had followed suit, and by 1911, over half the states had adopted some version of these systems. As one of us, Vic Amar, has previously written in the Vanderbilt Law Review, quote, "In reality, then, the 17th Amendment was a formalizing final step in evolutionary process. Indeed, by the time of the amendment's ratification, its need was in doubt." That is, other direct election devices were proceeding apace and becoming the laws of the land without constitutional change. I think it's fair to say that even without ratification of the 17th Amendment, direct election would be with us today in most, if not all, states. Unless the nation were to repeal the 17th Amendment and at the same time constitutionally prohibit the people of each state from trying to voice their Senate preferences for the benefit of state legislators, which would be a tall order indeed, popular election or something close to it may be likely to persist. Vikram David Amar is a Justice of Verdict columnist, Associate Dean for Academic Affairs and Professor of Law at the University of California Davis School of Law. He is a 1988 graduate of the Yale School of Law and a former clerk to U.S. Supreme Court Justice Harry Blackmun. He is a co-author, along with William Cohen and Jonathan Virat, of a major constitutional law casebook, and a co-author of several volumes of the Wright and Miller Treatise on Federal Practice and Procedure. Before teaching, Professor Amar spent a few years at the law firm of Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher. Guest columnist Alan Brownstein is a professor of law and the Buchiver and Byrd Endowed Chair for the Study and Teaching of Freedom and Equality at the University of California Davis School of Law.